Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Daphne Wysham of the Center for Sustainable Economy, who considers the reasons why Portland, Oregon climate activists attempted to block an icebreaker from sailing to the Arctic, where it was to join the Shell Oil Company's drilling fleet. Ann Kelly of the Sustainability Leadership Organization Cirrus, who talks about her group's campaign to enlist business support for President Obama's new clean power plan that regulates greenhouse gases from power plants. And Vijay Das, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizens Congress Watch, who discusses the effort to expand Medicare to cover the healthcare needs of all U.S. citizens on the popular program's 50th anniversary. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On his recent trip to Africa, President Barack Obama raised concern and protest when he declared that the government of Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn was democratically elected. Ethiopia is a key U.S. ally in the war on al-Shabaab militants in Somalia, but has one of the worst human rights records in Africa. The regime currently has over a dozen journalists and bloggers in jail, even after several prominent reporters were released ahead of Mr. Obama's visit to East Africa, including journalist Riyat Alimu. Just 2 months ago, the ruling party won every seat in parliamentary elections and rejected U.S. diplomats' special credentials to observe the election process. Opposition parties attempted to mount an effective campaign, but were subjected to intimidation and arrests as police violently broke up their political rallies. According to the Guardian newspaper, Bekele Nega, General Secretary of the Oromo Federalist Congress, which represents Ethiopia's biggest ethnic group, claimed at one polling station its victory by 800 votes to 40 was reversed to a 4,800 defeat. "I wonder," he said, "if people could tolerate this in America or Britain or wherever. We are very sorry that Mr. Obama's comment on our election is really supporting dictators." U.S. District Judge Dolly Gee has ruled that hundreds of detained women and children migrants should be released from U.S. detention facilities, asserting that federal authorities had violated key provisions of an 18-year-old court settlement that put restrictions on the detention of migrant children. In her July 24th decision, Judge Gee criticized widespread and deplorable conditions in holding cells at Border Patrol stations, specifically citing substandard sanitary conditions. Judge Gee gave the Obama administration an early August deadline to argue before her court why detained women and children should not be released within 90 days. Under a court settlement in the 1997 Flores v. Meese case, U.S. authorities must release migrant children or house them in the least restrictive environment. Under the policy, a juvenile cannot be detained for more than 72 hours unless they are a significant flight risk. The ruling is a clear defeat for the Obama White House strategy, designed to deal with last summer's influx of migrant children and teenagers fleeing brutal poverty and gang violence in Central America. According to the Los Angeles Times, U.S. immigration officials are currently detaining 1,700 parents and children in facilities in Texas and Pennsylvania. More than 55,000 undocumented migrant families who crossed the U.S.-Mexico border were detained in 2014. In the midst of a growing debt crisis, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico is opening the island's door to further billionaire hedge fund investors. For example, John Paulson, who made billions of dollars during the 2008 subprime real estate bubble that triggered the economic crash, has bought up three of the island's most exclusive resort properties and plans to invest $500 million in luxury residences. This comes on top of Paulson's purchase of $100 million in Puerto Rican junk bonds in 2014. Another U.S. hedge fund billionaire, Nicholas Prouty, invested $550 million in a San Juan marina to make it capable of servicing 200-foot-plus mega yachts. Trying to rebrand itself as a haven for the uber-rich, in 2012, the Puerto Rican government exempted residents from paying taxes on almost all of investment income. In recent years, the island's unemployment rate has doubled to 12.6%, twice the U.S. national average. With Puerto Rico sliding toward default on its bond obligations, so-called vulture hedge funds are eager to buy more of the island's distressed debt. Hedge fund managers are also making new demands for harsh austerity measures, which includes calling on the government to sell public buildings worth $4 billion and closing dozens of public schools. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
When a Royal Dutch Shell Company oil rig attempted to leave the port of Seattle for an oil drilling project in the Arctic in mid-June, hundreds of climate activists in kayaks and small boats attempted to block the giant drilling platform's path. After the Coast Guard intervened, Shell's Polar Pioneer oil rig was able to depart for Arctic waters. Fast forward to late July, when hundreds of so-called kayaktivists in Portland, Oregon, employed similar tactics in order to block Shell's icebreaker Fenica, carrying an essential containment device, from departing to join the oil company's Arctic drilling fleet in the Chukchi Sea off the coast of Alaska. On the St. John's Bridge, which spans Portland's Willamette River, more than a dozen Greenpeace activists rappelled over the side and suspended themselves with ropes over the water in an attempt to prevent the icebreaker from leaving Portland for its trip north to the Arctic. Despite the climber's 40-hour effort, the ship eventually was able to leave Portland after police dislodged the Greenpeace activists on the bridge. Environmentalists strongly oppose drilling for oil and gas in the Arctic, warning of the severe damage to the fragile ecosystem that would be caused by oil spills and the extraction of more fossil fuel that will further exacerbate climate change. Your reporter spoke with Daphne Wysham, Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy. Here she discusses the campaign to stop oil drilling in the Arctic and the recent civil disobedience actions in Portland.
When we found out the Fenica was coming to town, we said, you know what? Civil disobedience works. We're going to do this again. We're going to do this. We're inspired by the so-called kayaktivists up in Seattle. We're going to do this here in Portland, Oregon. We're going to blockade this ship. Now, they snuck it in to our port in the middle of the night at around 3 a.m., so there were very few people that were actually awake when it came in, but by the time day broke, after we realized the Fenica had, in fact, arrived in Portland, we had the troops rallied out there prepared to do a kayak blockade. And what we were completely surprised by was at 3 in the morning after we had started our kayak blockade, Greenpeace, 13 Greenpeace activists, rappelled from the St. John's Bridge and kept that blockade firmly in place from the air while we were on land and in the water. And we made history. For 40 hours, we kept that ship from going back to the Arctic, and we actually got it to turn around several times. And as a result, we not only drew attention to the insanity of Shell drilling in the Arctic at a time when science tells us we have to leave most proven reserves of fossil fuels in the ground, 80%, and we definitely cannot begin to exploit unproven reserves, such as the reserves that Shell hopes to exploit in the Arctic. There's a 75% chance of a major spill should Shell proceed with their drilling. This is according to the Department of Interior, and we think it's the definition of insanity to continue to exploit fossil fuels at a time when we are facing a planetary emergency that the Pope and the President both have said is a serious crisis. And so we were calling on the President to rescind the right to drill. And we're still hopeful that he will rescind Shell's right to drill in the Arctic. And we made sure that our mayor, Mayor Charlie Hales, who was invited to the White House to help Obama unveil his clean power plan, got his marching orders from us, which was absolutely make it crystal clear to President Obama that the city of Portland, along with Senator Merkley and other representatives from Oregon, oppose Arctic drilling and want to see strong climate action. None of this 2% here, 2% there. We need to shut off all new exploration for fossil fuels, and we need to ratchet down existing exports and rapidly move towards clean, renewable energy.
I wanted you to tell our audience a bit about both the short-term and long-term damage that people are concerned about with this new drilling for oil and gas in the Arctic.
Well, most people probably are aware, if they're keeping track of, you know, the crazy weather that has been hitting the East Coast, the West Coast, one of the reasons for this crazy weather is that the Arctic is melting. And the reason the Arctic is melting is because there's this, what scientists call the albedo effect. As the ice and snow melts, it exposes darker water, which in turn absorbs more heat, and you have a feedback loop where the Arctic is actually warming more quickly than other parts of the globe. So suddenly we have what used to be sort of like the air conditioner for the northern hemisphere is disappearing. And that's creating all kinds of chaotic weather, you know, everything from the wild derechos that hit the Washington, D.C. area to, you know, you've sort of seen these swings in weather from really high temperatures down to frigid temperatures overnight. A lot of that is related to the melting of the Arctic. So now that the Arctic is melting, Shell has this brilliant idea, let's go and drill for more oil up there. Let's stake a claim. In part, they want to do this so that they can show on their balance sheets that they have access to all of these reserves at a time when they're laying off 6,000 and other, you know, they have other signs of financial distress. They need to prove to their shareholders that they have in their bank account access to hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil. So it's one of the reasons that they are moving into the Arctic. It has very little to do with the need to access this oil and gas. As we know, the U.S. is now the number one producer in the world, thanks to fracking all over this country. We do not need access to the Arctic oil and gas. As Al Gore said, it's insane. And we should leave the Arctic alone. It should be off limits, not just because of the immediate environmental impacts, but because of the climate imperative.
That was Daphne Wysham, Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy. Find more news on the campaign to stop oil drilling in the Arctic by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Obama's August 3rd release of the final version of his Clean Power Plan calls for a more rapid transition away from coal than a draft plan made public a year ago. The final rule attempts to avoid what the White House called an early rush to gas and encouraged earlier adoption by states of renewable energy sources. The plan's stated goal is to have 28% of the nation's power produced by renewables by 2030, up from 22% in the draft plan. Many environmentalists praised the plan, while others said it didn't go nearly far enough, because scientists say 80% of existing fossil fuels must remain in the ground to prevent the planet from warming more than 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, the level above which catastrophic changes will be inevitable. Climate activists say one obvious thing Mr. Obama could do is revoke permits his administration has granted for oil drilling in the Arctic. Recognizing that the Clean Power Plan faces daunting political and legal challenges, Cirrus, a nonprofit group that works with companies and investors to promote sustainability, recruited 365 of its 1,500 member businesses and investors since June 2014 to sign a letter in support of the plan. Businesses, including Staples, The Gap, and Nestle, reached out to the governors of 29 states in which they're headquartered, urging them to consider backing the plan. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ann Kelly, Senior Director of the Policy Program at Cirrus and Director of BICEP, Businesses for Innovative Climate and Energy Policy. Here she talks about corporate support for clean energy and the philosophy adopted by some that going green is good business.
We have been developing supporters and cultivating support for the Clean Power Plan since the original announcement of the draft rules in June of 2014. And for 5 years prior to that, we'd been developing and really working with businesses who wanted to stand up for innovative climate and energy policy, and that's built into our name, BICEP. So We also launched the Climate Declaration back in 2013, which enshrines the notion that tackling climate change is one of the greatest economic opportunities of the 21st century. So that declaration has 1,500 businesses on it now. And we reached out to that group, as we have reached out to them several times over the last year for various advocacy opportunities. We specifically reached out to that group to say, you should get on and support the President's Clean Power Plan. And the letter, our letters, by the way, are still open. We're still going to be gathering signatures as the months go on. I think some companies probably wanted to actually see the final plan before they could give their support. And yet, it's notable that so many of them were quite willing to offer their support prior to even seeing the final version.
So it sounds like these businesses and investors are motivated by the chance to profit from a shift to clean energy rather than from a moral or ethical perspective regarding climate change.
Well, as you note, our letter says from the companies, our support is firmly grounded in economic reality, unquote. Clean energy solutions are cost-effective and innovative ways to drive investment, reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So, yes, companies recognize the economic realities. They recognize climate risk. They have, many of them, experienced climate risk. They've experienced the price volatility that comes from fossil fuels, which is very well known. And they understand the opportunity embedded in solving the climate crisis. So many of them have set public goals around their renewable energy purchases. They've set goals around greenhouse gas mitigation, set goals around energy efficiency. What they would like to have is the law to catch up with their own initiatives and innovation. And they recognize that the cost of inaction, the cost of waiting longer to tackle the problem, is much more than trying to solve the problem now.
So, Ann Kelly, when the Clean Power Plan was first proposed, it was all about converting power plants from coal to frack gas. And a lot of people were saying that moving from one fossil fuel to another is not great progress, especially since methane, another name for natural gas, is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And methane leaks could make gas as bad for the climate as coal. That dependence on natural gas seems to be shifting somewhat. But I wonder, does Ceres have members who are part of the natural gas industry?
We do not. We don't have any natural gas companies, corporate members or signers. We do interact with those companies all the time. We have a whole electric power team at Ceres that has many partners in that sector, and we're certainly talking with them all the time and helping them to fully appreciate climate risk. And also, obviously, we've done reports on the extreme water risk associated with fracking. So our position is pretty well known in that regard. There you're really looking at the power providers. And you'll notice that our letter and much of our advocacy work is really centered around energy users and energy purchasers. So it's just two different sides of the coin. But we also have heard about a shift in emphasis in the plan to do a better job of encouraging renewable energy purchases, to encourage the development of renewables instead of as much natural gas. Now, we don't know the specifics on that, but I would say that's a provision that we would definitely support and would suggest that that is moving in the right direction.
So your strategy is to have the companies that are in support of the Clean Power Plan contact the governors of the states in which they're headquartered and urge them to support the Clean Power Plan. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, now the real work is going to go toward the states, and that's how the plan works. So we felt it was important to have businesses and investors say to their governors, look, we've got your backs, and we know this is a difficult job ahead, but we encourage you to move quickly with your state implementation plan and to remember how important energy efficiency and renewable energy are, because they've been vital to each of these companies individually. And it really encourages the state energy officials that have the hard work now of rolling up their sleeves and figuring out how to make this work. Now, the good news on that front, you may have seen the report from the Union of Concerned Scientists a couple of weeks ago. Many, many states are well along the path toward compliance. In fact, we believe that most of the states won't need the amount of compliance time that they're actually going to get from the Clean Power Plan. We sent a letter to 29 of the states, and many of them are mixed in terms of their expressed support for the Clean Power Plan. There's a range of opinions. But again, this is really something that has to be looked at very carefully, because you might see a certain amount of top-line rhetoric from a particular state delegation that works in D.C. But when you really dig a little deeper and look at what the energy officials are actually doing and saying, you find that many of them are hard workers and working very hard on figuring out the specifics and the mechanics of how to comply with the plan. That's what's really happening on the ground, and that doesn't always make it into the news cycle.
That was Ann Kelly of Cirrus, a business sustainability organization based in Boston. Find more news and commentary on the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. July 30th marked the 50th anniversary of President Johnson's signing of the Medicare program into existence. In essence, the program is a single-payer health care system for America's 55 million senior citizens and those with serious and permanent disabilities. Widely popular among both young and old, Medicare has substantially lower administrative costs at 2% than the average administrative overhead of private for-profit health insurance companies. While many conservative politicians have often called for the privatization of Medicare, asserting that the program is unsustainable in its present form, Medicare's trustees recently announced that the Medicare Trust Fund will remain solvent until the year 2030. The Affordable Care Act's reduction in the growth of overall health care costs has had a positive impact on Medicare's longevity. And according to economists, raising Medicare premiums on higher income beneficiaries will serve to greatly strengthen the fiscal health of the program. But despite these facts, Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush recently called for the phasing out of Medicare and replacing it with a system of privatized vouchers. Not a very politically popular move with the nation's senior citizens. On the opposite end of the spectrum, however, Senator and now presidential candidate Bernie Sanders of Vermont, Representative John Conyers of Michigan, and Jim McDermott of Washington State have submitted legislation that would expand Medicare to include health care coverage for every American citizen, just as virtually all other industrialized nations around the world have done for decades. Your reporter spoke with Vijay Das, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizens Congress Watch. Here he talks about the current status of Medicare and the effort to expand the program to a universal single-payer healthcare system.
Medicare is a single-payer program dedicated to ensuring those over 65 and many disabled groups. And it is seen as a welcome addition to the fabric that is what people see as something untouchable when it comes to scaling back in American politics today. And through hard fights in the past and through lingering ones to preserve it, we are seeing folks in both the presidential as well as congressional politics discuss how we move forward in preserving it. I think it's welcome to note that many of the original advocates saw it as a stepping stone for America phasing out its for-profit model and working towards a universal single-payer healthcare system. And Medicare is a single-payer program, and it's just targeted towards those over 65.
Vijay, I wondered if you respond to the recent statement made by Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush when he said a week or so ago that Medicare should be phased out and privatized, giving senior citizens vouchers to buy health insurance in the private marketplace. What would actually occur if something like that were implemented?
I mean, these are ongoing kind of attacks against Medicare. One of the problems we're seeing is this ongoing privatization threats of Medicare, which is actually increasing some of the inefficiencies inherent in the program because of privatization campaigns, actually. And so a lot of the kind of threats we're seeing are far more ideological, and they also lend itself to this growing concern around how entrenched our for-profit healthcare system is and how much of a distraction it is in order for us to actually bring a both moral as well as cost-effective program that covers everybody, in which that we wouldn't have these kind of anomalies in place. we wouldn't be the largest per capita spender of healthcare with subpar outcomes in the entire developed world. We wouldn't have such unseemly kind of profit motives inherent within our healthcare system. And so these issues you bring up, particularly around these debates on Medicare, which happen every presidential and congressional election cycle, they speak to a greater challenge in which America needs to start thinking more seriously about catching up with the rest of the world.
Vijay, there are bills in the House and Senate currently that would expand Medicare to all U.S. citizens, creating a universal health care system like most every other industrialized nation in the world. The Senate bill sponsored by independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, John Conyers and Jim McDermott are sponsoring legislation that would expand Medicare for all in the House of Representatives. From what I understand, there's not really a chance that this is going to pass, and certainly we don't hear a lot of vocal support from President Obama either. How important is this effort to at least bring this type of legislation up for public debate?
You know, I read a poll today that said that Deloitte said that 30% of those on the ACA plans are satisfied. That leaves a whole chunk of people that aren't satisfied of their plans because of largely out-of-pocket. Candidate Hillary Clinton brought up, and maybe we should be thinking about how they're going to handle this issue, right, in some legislative fix. Guess what? We have a solution right in front of us, and we are just ignoring it because the seemingly large role of money in politics that governed the last health reform debate, right? So, I mean, it's really important that folks realize that there are solutions and that we have representatives in Congress. You have a lot of smart thought leaders who see the light, who are writing about this, who are chronicling challenges of what we're dealing with and are offering a way forward. And I think acknowledging those merits of their ideas is really important because they're sound. And I think ultimately that's going to win out over time. It's going to take some time. And it's also going to take some reforms that we have to get money out of politics because it's really destroying most important debate that everyone should be focusing on because it impacts all of us.
That was Vijay Das, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizens Congress Watch. Learn more about the efforts to expand Medicare to a universal single-payer healthcare system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.